great welcome to you. My name is Martin Goodman. I'm the director of the Philip Larkin Center. And one of the early joys of my job was to realize the power of invitation I had to ask people to come up. And so thought for a few days on getting the job, thinking, well, who would I most like to sort of to meet and to share their writing of? You know, to who have I had sort of most secret joy from in the writing? And it's one of those sort of secret joys that's good to share with everybody else. And the first name that came up was Hilary Mantel. I was absolutely thrilled when my invitation was accepted. And Hilary, of course, has gone on to even greater things than our invitation since then. So it's terrific that she's not only a wonderful writer, but also a trooper who's sort of hitting the road in the wake of having won the Booker Prize. I don't know of any prize winner ever who has actually brought such spontaneous pleasure for other people at winning a prize. And normally that the pleasure you win at other people winning the prize curdles a little. But there is really a sort of great joy from many readers and from the writing community at Hilary Mantel having won the Booker Prize for Wolf Hall. It's a tremendous book. I hope you're going to get some sense of that from this evening, but also some sense of Hilary's whole oeuvre. So just to sort of engage ourselves with it, can I just hear a welcome for Hilary Mantel, please? And we're actually going to have four short readings from an array of work. So we'll be ending the discussion talking about Wolf Hall and opening up to a question and answer session as well. But we're going to cover some of the other works on the way. And the first reading that Hilary is going to give us is from what I believe was your very first written work, A Place of Greater Safety, which was absurdly ambitious. You look at Wolf Hall and thinking, oh, wow, where did that come from? Well, the very first book was A Place of Greater Safety, which just takes on as a sort of a light theme for somebody starting out the entire French Revolution. And you have these sort of wonderful characters, Camille Desmoulins, Robespierre, and Danton. But we also have their friendships and their families and the women that surround them in their life. One of these women we meet first of all, she's Lucille. We meet her as a girl, passionately sort of writing into her journal. She believes that she's working out the plot in her journal, which is the plot of her life. So I'd like to ask Hilary to read one of these early passages about Lucille.
Lucille Desmoulins, who was the wife of the revolutionary journalist Camille, is around about 20 at this point in my book. She actually did keep a journal. She was a young lady of very strong and passionate and determined feelings. What she didn't know was that for a later generation, she would form a rather pathetic example of a romantic heroine. Lucille was 24 when she was executed during the Reign of Terror. And I suppose, therefore, the passage here resounds with irony. She did keep a journal, but it's fragmentary. And I have reconstructed some parts of it that we don't have, which is the privilege of the historical novelist. And I found out that in their house, there was an engraving of the death of Mary Stuart. And I thought, well, that's not Camille's, it's his wife's. In another room, Annette's daughter, Lucille, opened her new journal. Now for a fresh start, red binding, white paper with a satin sheen, a ribbon to mark her place. Anne Lucille Philippa Duplessis, she wrote. She was in the middle of changing her handwriting again. the journal of, I'm sorry, she's younger in this passage than I had told you. She's 16. The journal of Lucille Duplessis, born 1770, died, Volume 3, the year 1786. At this time in my life, she wrote, I think a lot about what it would be like to be a queen. Not our queen, some more tragic one. I think about Mary Tudor. When I am dead and opened, they will find Calais written in my heart. If I, Lucille, were dead and opened, what they'd actually find written is, I'm bored. Actually, I prefer Maria Stuart. She's my favourite queen by a long way. I think of her dazzling beauty among the barbarian Scots. I think of the walls of Fotheringay closing in like the sides of a grave. It's a pity, really, she didn't die young. It's always better when people die young. They stay radiant. You don't have to think of them getting rheumatics or growing stout. Lucille left a line. She took a breath, then began again. Open quote. She spent her last night writing letters. She sent a diamond to Mendoza and one to the King of Spain. When all was under seal, she sat with open eyes while her women prayed. At 8 o'clock, the provost marshal came for her. At her prie dieu, she read in a calm voice the prayers for the dying. Members of her household knelt as she swept into the great hall, dressed all in black, an ivory crucifix in her ivory hand. 300 people had assembled to watch her die. She entered through a small side door, surprising them. Her face was composed. The scaffold was draped in black. There was a black cushion for her to kneel on. But when her attendants stepped forward and they slipped the black robe from her shoulders, it was seen that she was clothed entirely in scarlet. She had dressed in the colour of blood. Here Lucille put down her pen. She began to think of synonyms. Vermilion, flame, cardinal, sanguine. Phrases occurred to her. Caught red-handed. In the red. Red letter day. She picked up her pen again. What did she think? As she rested her head on the block, as she waited, as the executioner took his stance, seconds passed, and those seconds went by like years. The first blow of the axe gashed the back of the queen's head. The second failed to sever her neck, but carpeted the stage with royal blood. The third blow rolled her head across the scaffold. The executioner retrieved it and held it up to the onlookers. It could be seen that the lips were moving, and they continued to move for a quarter of an hour. Though who stood over the sodden relic with a fop watch, I really couldn't say.
Rereading that, prior to this, I found myself laughing. Am I weird? I don't know, but I was laughing at the description of Maria Stuart and the joy of words. I noticed the Telegraph talks about the black sparkle of your writing, and that there's that's just an element I was enjoying there. But I also, when I was reading this, this was my sort of summer read in France. I thought this is a very sort of apposite book to read in France. But I came across Lucille and I felt there was a real sort of infusion, perhaps, of you in there. I wondered about the Lucille in you at that age. Was she active as a kid? Was there finding plot, working out your life through journal? Was there you spoke about her being a lady of, I can't read my writing, but she was strong, passionate, and determined, and a romantic. Was there this element of you in your North Derbyshire?
I always regarded Lucille as a little ninny, actually.
Ninny, oh dear.
she outlived her ninnydom.
Right.
But I did think of her as she was a very romantic young woman. And I think what she's doing there is she's writing her own historical novel in the grand manner. And I was always very interested by the fact that in French you can use the same word for the stage and for the scaffold. And I suppose that informed the whole book, really. Lucille is given to acting her emotions until she actually feels them. And by the end of the book, she has become a moral heroine because everything she's invented in melodrama, she actually does feel and she actually does live through and lives at the end of her own life, at the moment her own execution could not be more different from the romantic end described in the book. And yet, when other people described Lucille going to her death, the word they chose was radiant. Her husband was dead a few days before. She had perfect faith that she was going to join him. And people cried out, how beautiful she is, how mild she looks. And they described the dazzle of her white skin and the whole pathos of her appearance and her attempts to comfort another woman. Madame Hébert was also a victim of the terror and had been her husband's mortal enemy, but the two widows were dying together. And I think there's a sort of upward curve of moral development for Lucille, from there where we find her at 16 to where we find her at the end of the book, but she was only 24. But it's interesting, I mean, when I started writing this book, I was nearer to Lucille in age. I was between Lucille in age and the male characters. Her husband was 10 years older, but all the personnel of, not all, obviously, but many of the personnel of the revolution, many of its leaders, were of a certain generation, born, their births clustered around the year 1760. And many of those who came to prominence had, in fact, known each other as boys. By their mid-30s, they were dead. Camille was 34, Danton 35, Robespierre was 36, and they lived a compacted lifetime in the 5 years of revolution, 5 years in which they occupied the public stage and then the scaffold. So, yes, you're right, it's a young person's book. I couldn't write that now.
No,
I think because you have to live with the mentality of your characters. It has to be real. You have to be sincere in participating, I think, in their lives. And they see that in their 20s, their early 30s, they see not only their own lives before them, but a better country and a better Europe and a better world order. And they live perfectly in the belief that the existing order can be overturned and that life can be improved. And I have perfect faith. I wouldn't say I don't have faith in that now, but I would say it's tempered by experience and some scepticism. So I think if I were to try to write that book now, I might have certain advantages in commanding the material as a more experienced writer, but what you're always trying to do in historical fiction is push forward, move forward with your characters as if the end were not written, as if there were nothing fated about it. And I think it was because I was young myself that I could capture the excitement with which they approached every day.
You speak about Lucille being radiant when she goes to the scaffold, and the revolutionaries that you have, they keep shifting. The characters shift. There's no straight, no, this is the sort of person one is, but they stay revolutionaries. They stay fighting. And I was struck at the end of your book about the giant O'Brien by this particular paragraph that came in. King Conair had a singing sword. Do you know this? He was the son of a bird god. His head spoke after it was severed. And this is just inserted on that last page. But the giant O'Brien was, for those that don't know the book, well, buy it at the back, it's wonderful. But it's about this 18th century giant who comes out of Ireland with this sort of renegade bunch to tell his stories and be fated in Britain. And it's a sad sort of falling tale, but he still at the end has a great belief in the power of story. And your characters do keep moving on, moving forward. And with that thing about, you know, the singing sword and the severed head saying at the end, thank you for listening. I wondered, is that how you see it? Whatever happens, keep on telling your story.
I think so. This story of King Conor is one of many, it's an Irish legend specifically, but it's one of many legends of the severed head that still speaks or sings, and speaks or sings its complaints, its grievances. So in other words, don't think by severing a head you have finished that person. And I suppose a lot of my writing is an attempt to demonstrate that that is not so, that the heads do speak, yes.
Lucille was having great fun there with like vermilion and these words. And in others of your books, children are having great play with the discovery of language. They're suddenly trying out these adult words for the yes, first time. And I wonder what the process is like. I've got copied a little bit out of Wolf Hall. This is Thomas Cromwell is seeing Lady Anne for the first time. When he is admitted, she is pacing, her hands clasped, and she looks small and tense, as if someone has knitted her and drawn the stitches too tight. And I just adore that. And I wonder what's the process like of coming up with those images and those words. Do you do a whoop of delight? Do you chuckle? What's it like being you and finding these words?
Yes, and I think knitting was a man's trade, mm-hmm, in those days. Cromwell had been a wool trader. And of course, in knitting, one speaks of tension, and so it seemed just very apt. You've got this little woman who's a bundle of nerves, and she's forcing self-control on herself before what she knows is going to be an important conversation, and determined not to let the nerves show. So yes, as you say, this is the first sight of Anne Boleyn. Yes, I think you're very pleased when you find something like that, but I don't remember calculating it. It just, there it is on the page. Because I suppose, you see, all the time, you're looking to make your images, your whole system of imagery in a book, reflect the way your characters would think about the world. So that with Cromwell, he's been a wool trader. He's also been in Italy, where the luxury fabrics are traded. He knows about the cost and weight of material, and he knows about dyes. So when he sees some new grandee looming into view, He takes a good look at their clothes, and he sizes them up, and he prices them by the yard. And so textile and colour are what provide... texture and colour,
yes,
provide a huge...
Lady Jane Grey comes with his Kingfisher blue material.
Jane Seymour, yes.
Sorry,
yes, that's right. And you know, I can have fun with this because I guess everybody knows Holbein's picture, The Ambassadors. I am able to introduce The Ambassadors as real life figures, and the bishop, the one in the robe, at Anne Boleyn's coronation, Cromwell remarks on his, to himself, on that deep mulberry colour. And of course, it's a word to the wise, really. Some readers won't get it, and then some readers will get the visual image immediately. There is great satisfaction in doing something like that.
And going back to the idea of keeping right on to the end and believing in the power of your own story, and you wrote A Place of Greater Safety, which is a monumental work. I know it's 800 plus pages just in sheer length, but it's also embracing this whole tale. There's not even a sort of a first and a sequel. You've just done it all in one go. And it didn't sell. It didn't sell. And I know my own case. My first novels were turned down as being too remarkable. So I actually then said, okay, fine, to my agent, put them away. I'll write something that's not remarkable, and then you'll be able to sell it. And I wondered, and did you trim your own sails? Did you say, fine, I'll just give them what they want, so they can begin
absolutely
to want what I want to give them? Yeah.
Yes. And when I was 27 when I tried to sell A Place of Greater Safety, and there were no takers. It didn't fit into any category that people knew. It was very long. They didn't know who the author was, and that was important to people, as if they thought I had no authority to speak in this way. And also they didn't understand it because it wasn't a historical romance. It was a political novel. And what I did then, consciously, I went away and said, I will write a modern novel. It will be the standard length. It will be a comic novel. It will be as different from this as is possible. But I will make it the best I can do. And then if that doesn't get my foot in the door, then I might have to rethink. And luckily for me, it did pay off. But I then felt obliged to write a sequel to that novel. Every Day is Mother's Day was the first one published. Vacant Possession was the sequel. And then I had themes, stories queuing up, ready to be written, which demanded to be done before they got stale. And all this time, A Place of Greater Safety was sitting on a shelf. And I was getting frightened of it because I thought, what if it's no good? That was the work of my 20s. It was what I gave all my energy and time to. At that period in your life when a year, let alone 5 years, is a big investment. So I developed a dread that it wasn't really any good. So it was a spur of the moment decision to take it down. Yes. And when its existence did become known, then it was a different story. It still, I think, when it found its way into print, it wasn't an easy novel for people to assimilate. And there was, I have to say, among the reviewers, particularly of a certain generation, and particularly male reviewers, there was a distinct note of who does she think she is? But by that stage, I wasn't going to be abashed by that. And I had started off thinking, Everybody in the world will know more about the French Revolution than I do. But when my reviewers turn their attention to it, I realise they'd only actually ever read Thomas Carlyle's History of the French Revolution. And if it wasn't in Carlyle, they thought it was wrong. So I developed a sort of healthy contempt, which saw me through. But luckily, in other quarters, the reception of the book was very enthusiastic.
Did it open up the way for like other remarkable books, the Giant O'Brien and Beyond Black and Wolf Hall? Did it suddenly free you to do whatever you wanted?
Well, I think it was serving notice that I wouldn't be pigeonholed. And I think what's been very hard for my publishers over the years is that I keep coming up with different kinds of books. And they didn't even have the consolation anymore of knowing that I'd stick to the 20th century. So they have had the job of work, really, of making this list look coherent. To me, it is coherent, but people don't always see that first go. I know there are themes that are in virtually all my books, but the publicist has to start again every time. And of course, from their point of view, this isn't unreservedly a good thing because it makes it virtually impossible to build a public for an author because you've no way of classifying that author. It's far easier if you've got Anita Bruckner on your list. I mean, she's an author I love and respect. But anyone is any other one to a certain extent. And it is easy to know that if you like the last one, you'll probably like the new one too. I think with my books, it's not been, well, not an easy sell for my publishers, and not easy for my kind readers either.
And you varied the offering with non-fiction as well, some brilliant pieces in like the London Review of Books and New York Review of Books, and also your memoir. So maybe if you could read from that now for us, that would be wonderful. This is Giving Up the Ghost.
Giving Up the Ghost is a memoir that concentrates very heavily on very early life, of which I have very strong memories. I seem to have lived a whole lifetime before I went to school, a much richer life than I lived thereafter. And although I wasn't a child who learned to read early, but I developed an obsession with a book about King Arthur and his knights and organized my world around this. I was always getting people to read this book to me, so I knew it by heart. And therefore, I went to school with a bizarre vocabulary, which when, some other child pushes you and you say, avaunt, vile Katie, doesn't go down well. And the other important person in my family was my granddad, who had been in Egypt during the First World War, and he'd been a sergeant instructor in the machine gun corps, and he was given to reciting the manual. What a mad family I came from. So I can still remember bits of the official manual. And this was all part of my war equipment, I suppose, for the war I found I was in when I went to school. I went to school taking my knights, small grey plastic knights, in a bag. They were for a rainy day. My mother said this would be all right. One had simply never seen so many children. It took me a few days to establish their complete ignorance. My friend Evelyn had got trained to a degree, but no one here understood anything of the arts of war. Giant Kazonka? They didn't know him. Machine gunning? They simply looked blank. Suppose a camel came in and they had to command him. They went around with their mouths hanging open and their noses running with silver trails from nostril to top lip, with their cardigans bagging and sagging, their toes coming out of their socks, their hair matted and their bleary eyes revolving anywhere but where they should look. When they came back after dinner time, they stood in their places beside their infant chairs and gawped at the blackboard. Thereon was the chalked word, writing. The children chorused, writing. After a few days of this, I thought it would be a mercy if I varied the performance by clapping my hands and singing it to a syncopated rhythm, writing, writing. Mrs. Simpson said, do you want me to hit you with this ruler? I made no answer to this. Obviously, I didn't. But I didn't know either why she proposed it. I kept my bounds for a week or two, my cheerful preschool resilience. I was a small, pale girl, but I had a head stuffed full of chivalric epigrams and the self-confidence that comes from a thorough knowledge of horsemanship and swordplay. I knew also so many people who were old, so many people who were dead. I belonged to their company and lineage, not theirs. And I began to want to rejoin them without the interruptions now imposed. I couldn't read, but neither of the could any of the other children. And it was a wearisome uphill trail in the company of Dick and Dora, Dick and Dora's dog and cat, who were called Nip and Fluff, Dick and Dora's mummy, and Dick and Dora's garden. Sometimes Daddy put in an appearance, and if my memory serves, he was balding and tweedy. It was dull stuff, all of it. And as my head was already full of words, whole sagas which I knew by heart, I wasn't convinced that it was necessary. Before I was entrusted with paper, I was given chalk and a slate, but the slate was so old and thick and shiny that the letters slipped off as I tried to chalk them. At the end of the morning, I could only show letters up to D. Mrs. Simpson expressed surprise and disappointment. She didn't threaten violence. I was given plasticine to work the letters in. Instead of making them flat on the table, I wanted to make them stand up. So by the time the bell rang, I was once again only up to D. I was giving a fair impression of a child who was slow and stupid. I was both too old and too young for the place I'd arrived at.
Thank you. And I've noticed just of late with myself and my writing that I'm becoming a little wary of persistent themes that are seeking to emerge through fiction. And I'm seeing if it's possible to sort of deal with them elsewhere, and then let the fiction sort of go find its own feet without that burden of my own material coming in. Yeah. I wondered if this autobiography served a similar purpose for you. It's called Giving Up the Ghost. I wonder, in a way, what that symbolizes, whether there is a giving up of the ghost of childhood. I know there are other ghosts sort of come through it. Is it also saying of, I know James Baldwin says that it's hard to know what belongs in one book because everything keeps trying to sort of pile itself into the book that you're writing. So I wondered if the process of writing an autobiography freed some of those sort of themes, placed them, and let your fiction go a different way.
Yes, I think it has actually. There were reasons, and not all of them are apparent to me, but I think they will become so, why I had to stop and write a memoir. At that point, I was partway through Beyond Black, which is a book about a medium, that is a spirit medium, and I was doing a great deal of thinking about ghosts in their more literal, meaning, if a ghost ever has a literal meaning, and also what one could do with the word ghost, how the meaning expands and expands. And my stepfather had died when, just at the point where I was publishing An Experiment in Love, in fact, with timing that he would have been proud of had he been able to devise it, he died the day before my publication day. That, I know, I'm very aware, sounds harsh, but if there was one force in my life that tried to push me away from being a writer, it was my stepfather. And I got the point, I got the feeling that he was somehow standing in my light, dead, in a way that he hadn't done when he was alive. And I took his death as a starting point for the memoir. I wrote about my early life, pre-stepfather. I wrote about my life till I was 10 and took it really to the point where we moved away to a strange town. My real father passed out of my life. I took my stepfather's name, and my past was cut off. My future was different. But when I came to that point in the book, when I came to my teenage years, I couldn't write it. It passes by in 5 or 6 pages. And if I could have got away with it, it would have been even smaller than that. Because I couldn't approach that material at that point. So something to be done, not necessarily in another memoir, but something, that thing there is to be done, creeps into fiction in all sorts of ways, I think.
And I wonder what your relationship is to anger, because it's an interesting element to some of your writing. In a wonderful non-fiction piece that was in the London Review of Books that I've enjoyed teaching from, you're very angry on behalf of your husband with the National Health Service, with the way they treat you as a carer. You're in An Experiment in Love, you're angry on behalf of women, thin women. So intensity, a word of abuse flung at thin women is your definition of intensity. And then Carmel, who has very strong elements of you in her, there's a passage in that. She's been to a shoemaker's, and she's had a little sort of an extra notch put in the belt, and the shoemaker has spoken with her. And she says, "I blushed. I wasn't used to Londoners then. I'm still not. They talk so much. I always want to smash their jaws shut. I realize the reaction may be excessive." And when I've been away in Europe and I've come back, I've suddenly seen sort of England, probably more particularly than Britain, very acutely. And I've been proud of the anger I've had on everyone's behalf for 2 weeks. And then I feel it dimming. And I've actually written whole books fueled by anger, no, drafts of books. I've thrown them up, they've discarded that draft, but I've used anger as a fuel to actually sort of drive me forward. Do you use anger?
I think that's exactly the word. It is fuel. And it has to combust to some purpose, because it has to take you to a different place. I think anger, well, as they say, damn braces, bless relaxes. But better anger than bitterness, because bitterness shrivels. It would make your work small, just as it would make your life small. So I suppose I have been interested historically in people who were angry enough to do something, even though it put them in peril, knowing that anger doesn't always breed the wisest reactions as well. But sometimes it is actually the angry person who gives the situation a shove. And then let wiser counsel prevail. Let it all shake down. but it's a great propulsion, propellant for a narrative, as well as in life, I think.
And in the autobiography, there's a couple of pages that you say were the hardest to write, you know, saying the unsayable. When, as a small girl, you see, you know, this sort of little wave of demonic energy about sort of the height of a two-year-old, which then sort of inhabits you. And we may or may not, I'm a little wary of sort of treading on that territory, but you actually, at the same time as you were writing that, you tell me you were writing Beyond Black. And when we have this sort of medium who is very much affected by these sort of resident demons that have decided to sort of tag along with her life. I wondered, and that's the next passage I'd like you to read.
Yes, this would be Beyond Black.
Yes.
Alison is the medium. She's a central character. She's preparing in this passage to go on what she calls a demonstration of her powers, and she's going to talk to a big audience, rather the situation I'm in now. And she has a sidekick, an assistant, a PA, called Colette. Colette can't see spirits, but Alison can. Colette put her head around the dressing room door. "All right," she said, "it's full house." Alison was leaning into the mirror, about to paint her mouth on. "Did you find me a coffee?" "Or a gin and tonic," Colette said. "Yeah, go on then." She was in her psychic kit now. She had flung her day clothes over the back of a chair. Colette swooped on them. Lady's maid was part of her job. She slid her forearm inside Al's black crepe skirt. It was as large as a funerary banner, a pall. As she turned it the right way out, she felt a tiny stir of disgust, as if flesh might be clinging to the seams. Alison was a woman who seemed to fill a room, even when she wasn't in it. She was of an unfeasible size, with plump, creamy shoulders, rounded calves, thighs and hips that overflowed her chair. She was as soft as an Edwardian, opulent as a showgirl, and when she moved, you could hear, though she didn't wear them, the rustle of plumes and silks. In a small space, she seemed to use up more than her share of the oxygen. In return, her skin breathes out moist perfumes, like a giant tropical flower. When you came into a room she'd left, her bedroom, her hotel room, her dressing room backstage, you felt her as a presence, a trail. Alison had gone, but you would see a chemical mist of hairspray falling through the bright air. On the floor would be a line of talcum powder, and her scent, Je Reviens, would linger in curtain fabric, in cushions and in the weave of towels. When she headed for a spirit encounter, her path was charged, electric. And when her body was out on stage, her face, cheeks glowing, eyes alight, seemed to float still in the dressing room mirror. In the center of the room, Colette stooped, picked up Al's shoes. For a moment, she disappeared from her own view. When her face bobbed back into sight in the mirror, she was almost relieved. "What's wrong with me?" she thought. "When I'm gone, I leave no trace. Perfume doesn't last on my skin. I barely sweat. My feet don't indent the carpet." "It's true," Alison said. "It's as if you wipe out the signs of yourself as you go, Colette. You're like a robot housekeeper. You polish your own fingerprints away." "Don't be silly," Colette said. "And don't read my private thoughts." She shook the black skirt as if shaking Alison. "I often ask myself," Alison said. "Let's see now. Is Colette in the room or not? When you've been gone for an hour or two, I wonder if I've imagined you." Colette looped the black skirt onto the hanger and hung it on the back of the long mirror. Soon Al's big black overshirt joined it. It was Colette who had persuaded them into black. Black, she had said. Black, Alison, and perfectly plain. But Alison abhorred plainness. There must be something to capture the gaze, something to shiver, something to shine. At first glance, the shirt seemed devoid of ornament, but a thin line of sequins ran down the sleeve like the eyes of sly aliens reflecting black within black. For her work on stage, she insisted on colour: emerald, burnt orange, scarlet. The last thing you want when you go out there, she explained, is to make them think of funerals.
Thanks. So that was actually a sort of a private and special treat for me, because it's a page I've really enjoyed teaching over the last years, because I actually teach it as the perfect way to sort of to begin a novel, and you very extravagantly don't even use it as a beginning, it's your chapter two. Yes. And but just a wonderful use of detail and imagining the effects of a person passing through the room and this wonderful rivalry between Alison and Colette. And but I wondered with Alison, do you relate Alison's psychic gifts to a writer's gifts at all?
Absolutely. I relate to both those women, you see. The writer today is a visible presence, as you see. But the writer also wants to become invisible, like Colette. So your mind is divided as to what you should best be doing. It's the author, if you like, who is visible. But the writer is someone who sneaks around and covets invisibility, the better to observe what is going on. And I think there's a side of me that's the law student I used to be, and who is in fact very down to earth and businesslike, and is a very precise person, and like Colette, is insistent on having the facts, and is a skeptic and a debunker, not necessarily of the psychic realm, but for instance, of history. I try not to take anything on trust. I don't believe people's versions. I scrutinize them very carefully. But then I think there is another side of me that is purely Alison. I spend my time talking to the dead. And like Alison, I always feel, and I have felt all my life, very conscious of an invisible reality that is just as powerful as the visible one. And you have to somehow live with that. Find yourself a false self. Maybe collect the false self so that you appear to people not to be clinically insane. You have to have a self who can go out and deal with the world for you. But in my private heart, I've been, I think, like Alison, nudged around and pushed by, chivied by invisible realities. Because, of course, your characters, they are all invisible to you. And the world you create as a writer, even if it's the contemporary world, is also purely a construct of air. And yet, to you, it has an intense reality, sometimes greater than that of the real solid world that other people are living in. So I was taking Alison, I suppose, as the figure of a writer, as the writer. The writer and the professional medium are allowed to spend their time talking to the dead, and nobody tries to section them or give them drugs. And the reason is, it seems to me, that they earn money from it. So it's a respectable activity. People understand it.
Was there any sort of hesitation in presenting it into England? When I sort of left to sort of work in America, I suddenly found there was like a market, a wish to have me talking about spiritual matters. So I was suddenly writing about sacred mountains and Indian holy women and shamanic journeys through the jungle and hallucinogenic trips, and they loved it. But I knew it was putting me completely out of the pale back in England. So when I came back, I had to find a mainstream book. And you write about, when you were writing about those demonic energy, that demonic energy in Giving Up the Ghost, that it was the hardest thing you'd ever written, that it was hard to find the words. And then you are writing about a wonderful, compelling account of a psychic and that psychic realm. Was there any part of you that was found difficulty presenting that into Britain?
Yes, I know exactly what you mean, because it's something I found all my life. I'm given to figurative language, even if I were writing shopping list. And unfortunately, it frequently happens that people take you quite literally. And they take your belief in ghosts and the supernatural to be a far more solid and decided thing than it in fact is. The whole of this realm is vaporous to me, as it should be. And Beyond Black is very much not a book about whether Alison is a fraud or not. That's not the question the book is asking. It's asking, what is it like to be Alison and to live in two worlds? And I was actually delighted that people did seem to take that on board. Although the really nice thing I found, when I was going around the world and the book was a reality and people would say, what are you doing next? And I'd say, a book about a medium, and everyone would have a ghost story to tell me, or a story about a medium. These were gorgeous, because over the time I began to see how strongly they ran to archetype and how there are certain kinds of ghost stories, and they cross the border into urban legends. And I think sociologically it's fascinating. And the hardest headed man will have a ghost story for you. Which ends up, of course, I don't believe in anything like that, but it was funny, wasn't it?
And just a question on style from this book, and also from like A Place in Greater Safety. And in all your books, dialogue is very important, the way people speak. And sometimes that dialogue just takes over the whole book, so it just becomes, it's paginated like a script. And I read an interview of yours that, you know, when you get stuck, you go and read Ivy Compton Burnett. So I thought, well, let's just go and try her out. I'd never read her. You know, it's one of those brand names, you know. So I went and picked up Mother and Son, and what a remarkable gothic, weird book it is. It's astonishing. And it's entirely dialogue, or 98% dialogue, people talking. Yes. Do you go to sort of to writers like that, and you know, maybe sort of women writers that either affirm what you want to do or give you ideas and say it's okay to be so striking with, you know, dialogue, and maybe Beryl Bainbridge with bizarreness?
Well, I have a peculiar relationship with Ivy Compton Burnett's work, and only with hers. And I'm very aware that she's a minority taste, and that a lot of people now haven't read her. But her books are written almost in the form of a play, but with no character specified, and very little in the form of he said, she said, and so on. But I have obviously written many different kinds of dialogue in many different voices, whereas Ivy's characters are all of a social class, and they are all Edwardians. So it's quite different in that way. But there's something in her tick-over speed that is the same as mine. And sometimes it happens, when you're in the middle of a book, you've been writing intensely, and then maybe you're exposed to some bad writing or some banal conversation and your spring breaks. And then I have to go and pick up any one of her books and read a chapter or two. And then when I wake up the next morning, I've got that speed back, that rhythm. So it's a peculiar thing about her books. But dialogue, it offers various pleasures. I try to get the voices right, obviously, for my characters to portray character, but also to drive the plot forward. But what's a great pleasure is to write dialogue in a book where either almost all the characters are clever and sharp, or there is a strongly marked regional accent or dialect. But Beyond Black drove me mad because they're just those whiny all-purpose southerners with estuary accents. And I threw in an Irish ghost just for relief, relief for my ear. And when Mrs. McGibbitt was on the page, I was so happy. But I would say it caused me a great problem. Making their voice true, and yet that is the voice of Alison and Colette, making it true, and yet making it entertaining. Not making it banal, because naturally their speech would be banal, but there's a great difference between the speech one hears and the naturalistic, in inverted commas, dialogue that one puts onto the page.
And moving on towards your final reading now, from Wolf Hall, and I was struck by some of the most terrifying children that I've met in literature come from your recollections of growing up in Derbyshire, it seems to me, even though the grey cardigan ones, you brought some of them up into the piece you read there. And you're not really one of the world's most sentimental writers when it comes to children. And the piece that you're going to read to us now is an introduction to who would be the great queen, Queen Elizabeth I,
yes.
First seen by through Cromwell's eyes as the Princess Elizabeth.
Yes, this is Henry's virtually he's destroyed the unity of Christendom and invented his own church so that he can divorce his wife Catherine of Aragon, marry Anne Boleyn, have a child by her, and the child comes along and guess what, it's a girl. And of course nobody at this stage knows it's going to be the future Elizabeth I. Now Anne Boleyn has been a pretty unsympathetic character to this stage, and indeed I think she shows her unsympathetic face in this passage as well, but also something else. The Mary referred to is Mary Tudor, the king's daughter by his first marriage. The birth of the child Elizabeth displaces the Princess Mary from the succession, and Mary is declared in effect illegitimate. But here is Anne showing off her new daughter to the world. And you need to know that Anne Boleyn was terrifically unpopular among the ordinary people of England. As far as we had public opinion in those days, she was on the wrong side of it. The princess, unswaddled, had been placed on cushions at Anne's feet, an ugly purple, grizzling knot of womankind, with an upstanding ruff of pale hair and a habit of kicking up her gown as if to display her most unfortunate feature. It seems stories have been put about that Anne's child was born with teeth, has six fingers on each hand, and is furred all over like a monkey. So her father has shown her off naked to the ambassadors, and her mother is keeping her on display in the hope of countering the rumours. The king has chosen Hatfield for her seat. And Anne says, "It seems to me waste might be saved and the proper order of things asserted if Spanish Mary's household were broken up and she were to become a member of the household of the Princess Elizabeth, my daughter." And Cromwell is now speaking. "In the capacity of..." The child is quiet. Only he notices because she's crammed a fist into her maw and is cannibalizing herself. "In the capacity of my daughter's servant," Anne says. "What else should she be? There can be no pretense at equality. Mary is a bastard." The brief respite is over. The princess sets up a screech that will bring out the dead. Anne's glance slides away sideways, and a sideways grin of infatuation takes over her whole face, and she leans down towards her daughter. But at once, women swoop, flapping and bustling. The screaming creature is plucked up, wrapped up, swept away, and the queen's eyes follow pitifully as the fruit of her womb exits in procession. Cromwell says gently, "I think she was hungry."
Well, thank you for the readings, and the readings have confirmed sort of my own feeling about Wolf Hall. There's been a lot of critical take about the fact that you're writing it in the present historical tense. But what I felt all along was that occasionally there is this "you" comes in, and the narrator is addressing them. But I've always imagined sort of you reading this book to me. You're actually sitting on stage, maybe in this Tudor gown, and reading away. And you do use this sort of curious sort of use of the pronoun "he." Now, when he is always Cromwell, but it's almost as though because you know him that well, you know, it's someone you know well. You keep saying about "he." And using the present tense of yourself as the narrator of this book, possibly from within the period, so that you're there with that acuity of perception. Only he notices that she was cannibalizing her thing. Only he sees it.
Yes, it's a very cinematic device in a way. I am very aware that some readers have found this "he" hard to cope with. But as soon as you realise, which actually you should on the first page, that Cromwell is "he," then the problem goes away. The camera is on his shoulder, or to put it better, you are looking through his eyes. So you are seeing what he sees, hearing what he hears. Occasionally, there is a comment that flies in from the outside to remind you you're reading a novel. But mainly, you're with Cromwell, behind his eyes, and you have no experience outside the present moment. You have your memories, but that moment is what you are in, hence the present tense. And these decisions, of course, an author is supposed to brood over. What is my viewpoint? What tense do I use? But actually, I have to say that with this book, they were taken in an instant. As soon as I had written the first lines, because the book begins with a 15-year-old Cromwell being beaten up by his father, who's a blacksmith, and we know from the records of the local courts was a very violent man. And the boy is on the floor, he's looking up at his father, and he's thinking, "He's going to stamp on me." And he can see his father's boot, and he's so close that he can see where the twine has sprung free and there's a knot in the twine, and he's thinking, auntie'll blame me for bursting his boot. And it was quite obvious to me that this is where the book is coming from. It's looking up so close that you can see Walter's boot and your own blood on it. So after that, for me to start calling him Cromwell, Cromwell did this, Cromwell did that, seemed to be imposing a quite false layer of formality between us, because we were behind his eyes, and the decision for the present tense was taken as well immediately, because everything in those first pages is, where will Walter move? Will something distract him? Will someone come along before he stamps on his son and the book is over before it begins? And of course it occurred to me, the first words of the book are, so now get up, now get up. And of course it occurred to me that what's Cromwell going to be saying to himself on the scaffold at the end of his life? His execution was one of the nasty ones, not competently carried out. He had time to know he was dying, and I felt in my mind he would be saying to himself, so now get up, so now get up. And it's, yes, take one more breath. So the whole story was enclosed for me between that phrase and its inevitable repetition, which will, in Cromwell's life, it will take 40 years to come about. Who knows, it may be 40 years before I produce the sequel. But I very much had in mind when I wrote Wolf Hall, I didn't know when I began that there were going to be two books. I didn't know this story would stop when it did. But I have taken Cromwell in this book to the summer of 1535. And the book I'm working on now will take him over the next 5 years. His further rise and rise, and to his fall from power in the summer of 1540 and his execution, after which his afterlife begins. Henry very soon wanted him back, but his reputation, the reputation as an evil man, which stalks him to this day, was generated in those weeks after his death, when his papers were impounded, and he no longer had the power to speak, because that of him which remained, which was writing, was impounded, and he was silenced till now.
I think I better silence my. I got two more favourite questions, but I better sort of pass the silence myself.
Yes.
Now and pass the microphone out to anybody that we have a roving microphone. Here it is. Lynn's got the roving microphone. Would anybody like to claim it and ask a question? Come on, we haven't got. There is it. Well done, Sarah.
Obviously, Thomas Cromwell is very. He's your character, and this is what the story is about. I wondered whether you started with Thomas Cromwell, or whether your interest was in your inspiration. Really, is the question for Wolf Hall. Were you interested in the period, or was it the character of Thomas that inspired you?
Yes, it was Cromwell. I've been auditioning him for years. I think it's very important that you choose your character. He's got to be the right person for you. You've got to be able to work with him. It's like a biographer choosing their subject. This is going to be a long relationship. And back in the 70s, when I was writing A Place of Greater Safety, I did think of myself as a historical novelist. I had in mind, right, when I have done A Place of Greater Safety, whenever that is, I'll have a go at Thomas Cromwell. So all these years he's been there. And do you know what I think it is for me? It's this business of starting nowhere. It's the blacksmith's son. It's this astonishing rise from not exactly poverty, but very much the wrong side of the tracks if the Tudors had had tracks.
I ask you to qualify what you said about anger, which I think of as a negative, destructive and cruel emotion. I've been thinking, since you said it drove you, about whether, for me, would furious indignation be a better description, or would that be too pallid for you? Is what you're thinking, what we feel about bankers, but not about our near and dear?
Yes. Well, you know that it's Swift's epitaph, isn't it? Gone where fierce indignation can no longer tear his heart. I think, yes, you put your finger on it. I think it is fierce indignation, which is a subdivision of anger. Yes, which is, if it were the determinant in my life, I suppose I wouldn't be a writer. I would be an activist of some description. For me, it's almost as if I've stood back and I've watched as other people are torn by fierce indignation. And I think it's something that you feel intensely when you are young. Hence my revolutionaries. And I suppose my fierce indignation now is a little slower to spark into life. Perhaps I'm more judicious in my approach. Or perhaps I'm more like Thomas Cromwell, who has a strictly limited and practical view of how changes can be brought about. No place for indignation in his world, and no place for anger, except occasionally. What I have here is an extremely self-controlled man, but sometimes in his letters, real passion flares out between the lines, and it's always remarkable when that happens. And there you can see maybe how a younger Cromwell was driven, but he's learned to channel the anger, he's learned to use it, which I think is something that we all must do if we want to be effective in the world. But this is the lesson you learn as you get older, isn't it?
One more question.
Could I bring you to 8 months on Gaza Street, if you don't mind? I know it's been quite a while, but I was interested in, when I was rereading that character, Frances Shaw is flying to Jeddah, and she's thinking about the case of the very tragic Leeds nurse who fell off or was pushed off a balcony in Saudi Arabia. And that obviously was a very recent case when you were writing the book. And it has, of course, come into public light again because her father has decided that he's going to now bury the body. And I suppose my question is about this: how, to what extent, obviously, for the character, it frames her interpretation to some degree of Saudi Arabia. And of course, it's a very tragic and iconic case. And to what extent do you think that is sort of that case has also frames a public interpretation to or a reaction to Saudi Arabia? And the second point that I question related to that is it's a novel that I really love, but it absolutely terrifies me as well. And I wonder if you could comment on how do you generate such terror in the novel? There's the moment when she's in the apartment and she's opening all the blinds and the windows and she realizes that she's surrounded by walls. I'd just like to, if you could comment more on that, how you cultivate that terror, because it is a terrifying, for me it's a very terrifying book and a very alienating, but the idea of the cultural experience this particular cultural experience is very alienating for her.
Yes, when I wrote 8 months on Gaza Street, which, as this lady says, is set in Saudi Arabia, I could not presume that my readers would know about the Helen Smith case or that they would have it in mind. It was recent, but not that recent. And I couldn't presume that perhaps, you know, if my book were to be translated into to other countries. But obviously, I couldn't assume a public knowledge of the case. But I did myself follow Ron Smith's efforts to find out the truth about his daughter's death. And I entered into those efforts with intense sympathy because I realized that we were looking at a society there that had a strange relationship to the truth when evaluated by our standards, which didn't make it wrong or hypocritical. It just made it different. And I realized that when you had lived in Saudi Arabia for some time, you got some idea of how the thing worked. But Ron Smith, flying in, could not possibly have picked up the subtleties of it. And it happened that while I was living in Saudi Arabia, one of our neighbors, a woman, was killed in a road accident. But when her husband, when the people came to tell him of this, that is his Arab colleagues, they said, "Your wife has had an accident. Then your wife is very ill." And only after quite some circumlocution did they come to, "Your wife is dead." And then we could not find the body. And we went around the hospitals asking at the morgues. After a little while, the man began to think, perhaps a ghastly mistake has been made. Perhaps she is not dead. And eventually we found her. There was no conspiracy. There was no cover-up. It was an accident, nothing more sinister. But the way the society operated, there was a tendency to back off, to obfuscate, and to put layers of politesse between you and the brutal truth. And I think in Ron Smith's case, that a lot of the time what seemed to him conspiracy was actually just cock-up. And I think that was a sad truth, but I'm not passing judgment because on the case, because I think there may well have been, I don't believe Helen died by accident, but I wouldn't put it higher than misadventure, let's say. I wouldn't be able to say that she was murdered. Or unlawfully killed. How do you scare people? Well, I've almost said it really. In a society like that, where there is an instinct to secrecy, quite ordinary things look, they take on a shadowy dimension. So, even to walk into an empty room, you wonder what's just happened there. And what we've got in Frances Shaw's case, Frances isn't me, by the way. She's far angrier and ruder than I am. Frances is living in a block of four apartments. The apartment above is empty. Sometimes she thinks she hears noises coming from it. So what it is, it's Bluebeard's room. One of the things that 8 months on Gaza Street is, as well as being an exploration of a certain mindset and a certain geographical region and a religious mindset, it's also a Gothic novel after the pattern of the Mysteries of Udolpho. The only thing is, I didn't realize that till I'd written it. How perfectly, because I was writing out of my own situation. And the Gothic heroine back in the 18th century is disempowered. She is held in thrall by the expectations of society and controlled by the men in her life. As soon as a modern woman goes to Saudi Arabia, she finds herself hurtling backwards in time and in exactly that situation. So what I was writing was, as far as I was concerned, the unvarnished truth, except, of course, one always varnishes it a bit. But when I'd done it, I realised that I'd done far more than I intended. I think that some of this kind of thing happens because I don't come from an English studies background. You know, I'm a law graduate. I didn't study English at university. And in some respects, as a novelist, I'm a naive thinker. So I just walk forward and put down things as I think they ought to be. And only later do I try to analyse my effects.
Thank you very much. Yeah, 8 months on Gaza Street was the first sort of novel of yours I read after having sort of lived in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia myself. And I think it captures that claustrophobic pathology of the country really well. And I'd just like to thank you enormously for my own sort of pleasure and delight in having you here. And for that illumination and entertainment and the truly gorgeous readings that you did. So please,
thank you.
Thank you.